Well, about 20,000 years ago, humans trekked along the margins of a shallow lake in Australia, leaving behind records of their passage in the soft, wet sand. In 2003, an Aboriginal woman, who is likely a descendant of those early Australians, stumbled across dozens of time-worn footprints in the area. Excavations of the site have since uncovered hundreds more. The discovery, detailed in a recent issue of the Journal of Human Evolution, represents the largest collection of that era of human footprints in the world, and the only footprints from that era ever found in Australia. In total, 457 footprints have now been uncovered. That period stretched from about 2 million to 12,000 years ago. Man, there's so many things going on this planet we just don't know about. I'll tell you one person, though, who knows a lot about what happened millions of years ago, Michael Cremo, and he's our guest next on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, and the European Association of Archaeologists. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with a spirituality from the Eastern tradition. Michael is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues, and in the course of a few months' time, he might be found on pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national radio or television show in the United States or any other country, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to the audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. Our guest tonight, Michael Cremo. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing really great, George. Good to be with you and your audience again.
Always a pleasure. And, you know, wherever I go, somewhere in the conversation, somebody mentions your name. It's absolutely uncanny. I mean, we may be talking about where we visited millions of years ago by extraterrestrials. How old might civilizations be? Everybody always mentions your name.
Well, you know, that's really gratifying. I'm happy to hear the words getting around like that. I sort of find it very interesting that such a great variety of groups of people invite me to come and speak to them. I mean, as you know, my main work has been in archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, but UFO organizations invite me to speak, paranormal organizations, theosophical organizations, yoga societies. Seems everyone's interested in this phenomenon of knowledge filtration, whereby a lot of the facts that we need to really get a good picture of who we are and where we came from are just out of view.
I remember talking to you back when I was doing my local show in St. Louis out of KTRS, and I was just hooked when we talked about forbidden archaeology. I mean, I just, the things we talked about, and we're going to go through some of that again because it is just so fascinating, some of the discoveries from millions of years ago. It is mind-boggling. I'm at a point, Michael, and I guess you are too, that this planet is much older in terms of human life than we really realize. And I think they were pretty technologically advanced, don't you?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, if you look at practically any of the writings of the ancient civilizations, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India are the ones that I'm most familiar with, but they speak of spaceships, of weapons resembling our modern weapons. They had apparently the ability to look inside the human embryo and see what was going on. So it appears, yes, ancient people did have quite a bit of knowledge that perhaps, some of it perhaps, that we're rediscovering.
I think something very horrible happened on this planet, Michael, a long time ago. I don't know what it was, but something happened.
Well, I think there have been a series of catastrophes that have taken place in the history of life on Earth. If you go back to the time of Plato and Aristotle, the Greek philosophers, they said that, you know, time goes in cycles. There have been periodic devastations, after which civilizations have risen again and again and again. So I think we're in one of those cycles now, and I think we're in the downside of the cycle.
Yeah, I think so too. Do you think when these devastations occur, they wipe out civilizations entirely, or might there have been a few human beings left, maybe the type where people would say it's Adam and Eve, for example, because there weren't too many people left?
Well, it appears that the world has been repopulated many times. Now, perhaps there are refuges where populations exist. For example, in the ancient Sanskrit writings, it says that even now there are psychic refuges within the Himalayan mountains, deep within the Himalayan mountains, where there are people waiting to repopulate the earth after the next devastation. So it could be something like that. I think we also have to consider the fact that you have to take a wider view and look at the whole universe and not just our Earth planet. There may be human-like people living on other planets that could be a source of, you know, repopulation of the Earth after these events as well. So, but I think it's very, very interesting. When I looked, you know, at the standard paleontological history of the world, you know, if you go back to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth up to the present, they say there have been six major extinction events that have taken place. The most recent one having been the one that extinguished the dinosaurs. When I looked at the ancient Sanskrit writings, I found something pretty interesting. It said that, you know, time goes in vast cycles. One of the cycles is called Manvantars, and they last about 300 million years each. According to the ancient Sanskrit calendars, we're now in the seventh of these periods, which means there have been six before, and they tell us that between each one of them, there has been a devastation after which the Earth has had to have been repopulated. So it's a pretty amazing coincidence that both according to modern paleontology and to the information that we can get from these ancient wisdom sources, there have been six major devastations that have taken place in the history of life on Earth thus far.
What do you think happened to them, Michael, in terms of, and we'll get into what might have occurred in terms of devastation, but also in terms of the archaeological find? I mean, we find some old bones, and we find, the Valley of the Kings and things like that, but in terms of structures and buildings, there's really nothing from millions of years ago. I mean, do you believe, for example, and let's use Los Angeles for a moment, if a million years went by and nothing was built other than what we already have here, would it all be gone? Would it disintegrate to just dust where people wouldn't even see it anymore?
I think a lot of it would disintegrate into dust over the course of years. I mean, there were huge battles that took place in Europe during World War II, and you can go back to those places now. I mean, there should be, you know, just tons of equipment and stuff lying around, but it's not there. You can hardly find a thing. So I think over millions of years, there can be a lot of destruction. Of course, there are some cases, you know, that I've talked about in Forbidden Archaeology where you do have apparently some structures from very, very ancient times remaining. There was the case of a case in Oklahoma at Heavener where you had some coal miners going down 2 miles beneath the surface of the earth, and they were blasting out what they call rooms in the mine.
Yeah.
You know, they used dynamite to blast out a chamber, and then they clear the coal out. So these miners reported that they had blasted out a chamber, you know, deep within the earth in this coal mine, and they'd found at the opposite end of the chamber, as they were clearing away the coal, they found a wall. And this wall, according to the report, was made of 6-inch polished blocks of stone, and they were so polished you could see reflection in them.
2 miles in.
And if, you know, like coal at that depth, that's about 300 million years old. That's from the Carboniferous period. Yeah, so you're talking about something very, very ancient.
And would that have been on the surface at that time?
Yes, because the coal is made from plants, which grow on the surface.
Right.
So at one point, it would have had to have been at that level. It would have had to have been from the surface somehow, and it got buried, which happens. I mean, you can go to the Grand Canyon. You can see deposits laid one after another, you know, going a mile straight down. So it's not that there's no evidence at all of ancient structures, although it's very, very rare. I think one thing we have to keep in mind is that the archaeological record, the geological record, is incomplete. Geologists tell us that of all the sedimentary layers that have ever been laid down, because that's where you're going to find these fossils, in the sedimentary layers that have been laid down, layers of sandstone and silt and all kinds of rocks like that, that's where you're going to find these remains. The geologists tell us that of all the deposits that have ever been laid down on Earth, 90% or more are gone, and they've been worn away by erosion and other, you know, geological processes. So, and then we've only looked at a tiny bit of it, and those who are doing the looking, they have all their different theoretical preconceptions that result in this knowledge filtering that I'm talking about. So it's as if, like, we were trying to understand, say if you have a book, you know, written in a foreign language, a 1,000-page book, and you've only got 50 pages left, and you rip them up and put them into a box, and you pull out a few pieces and look at them, you know, how much can you really tell about what the whole book was really about? You can learn something. You can definitely learn something. I think it's the same with this archaeological evidence. I don't think we're ever going to be able to get the complete story of the history of human life on Earth, you know, by that method, because a lot of it's simply gone. Fortunately, I think there are other ways to get at the truth. There are the records left by some of these ancient civilizations which contain information. But some people don't put a lot of trust in that. They want to see the stones and the bones and the artifacts. There are artifacts. There are human skeletons. There are human footprints that go back many, many millions of years. And as incomplete and imperfect as this evidence may be, it's enough to tell us that the current theories are wrong and that humans have been on this planet for vast, vast periods of time.
Can you have high technology and still, let's say, have the fundamental archaeological living style of stone houses? And I'm thinking of Star Wars, for example, where they had spaceships and incredible communications. Yet when you look at how they lived in, you know, stone homes and things like that, things that today we would think might be the Dark Ages. In a movie like Star Wars, they were perfectly fine living like that, but they still had high technology. Is it possible we had that kind of living environment back millions of years ago?
Yes, I think it is, and that's, I would say, in the ancient Sanskrit writings we find descriptions of exactly that. Another thing I think we have to keep in mind is that in the past, you know, people may have been making use of technologies that involved more subtle elements and more subtle energies than we're accustomed to now. I think we're dealing with matter at its grossest level, basically. And I think in past civilizations, they may have been able to deal with things on a more subtle level. In other words, they may have had spaceships that they didn't build in factories, but that they manufactured in some other way.
Right.
So, and I think a lot of, this takes us into, you know, what might be called the paranormal and, you know, things of that sort. And I think a lot of our technology today is simply an attempt by us to recreate faculties and abilities that people had naturally in very distant times. For example, I think our computers and television and radio just may be our way of trying to reproduce through technology abilities, telepathic abilities that people normally had in more ancient times.
They had something because, you know, we don't find, we're not really stumbling across the ancient electrical grid system, for example. We you know, I can't find that. Nobody
well, of course,
can.
we have to think like, well, what would that sort of thing look like after 10 or 20 million years?
Right,
like,
exactly.
Say, what if people had laptop computers, you know, 10 million years ago? Well, then you have to think, well, what's a laptop computer going to look like after, you know, 10 million years? It's not going to look like the one that's sitting on my desk right now.
No, it won't.
You know,
that's
it's going to be, the plastics are going to be melted. Most of the metals will corrode except gold. And, you know, that's one of the reasons gold is so valuable. It doesn't corrode. It doesn't oxidize like most metals do. I think that may be one reason why some of the more ancient artifacts that have been found have been made of gold. You know, it was the case of that was reported in 1892 in the Morrisonville Times of the state of Illinois here in the United States, where, you know, a woman was putting a big piece of coal into a coal burning stove, and the piece of coal broke in half, and inside she found a gold chain.
Inside a piece of coal that was millions of years old.
Right. And from the report, we were able to tell, it mentioned the mine that the coal came from. So by doing a little research and the geological reports about the mine, we could see that the coal in that particular location was about 300 million years old.
300 million.
And then there was an entirely separate case, which was mentioned in a scientific journal called The Geologist, you know, published in the year 1862, that told of a human skeleton that was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County, Illinois, mm-hmm. the same state that this gold chain was found in. And it was there were medical doctors present who examined the bones. They said they were those of a human being, but they were found 90 feet below the surface of the ground, and directly above the layer where the skeleton was found was a thick layer of slate rock that extended for hundreds of yards in all directions. It was about 4 or 5 feet thick. It was unbroken. Because that's one of the excuses that sometimes people give. You know, skeptics will say, well, the skeleton had to have come down from some higher level. It really didn't belong in the layer
right.
where it was found. It slipped down through a fissure or something. But in this case, you've got a solid layer of rock, you know, going for hundreds of meters, hundreds of yards in all directions above the skeleton. So there wasn't any, and it was unbroken. So that means that skeleton really did belong in the layer in which it was found. In this case, about, you know, 300 million years or so.
It is amazing, Michael. It really is. Hey, when we come back, let's talk about what you think happened to these civilizations, and then we'll get into Devolution, which is one of your new works. He's also, of course, a very prolific author of a book called Forbidden Archaeology, which was the first book that gave me my exposure to Michael Cremo and his theories, and they really are something. And both of them still available, Michael?
Yes, they are. They're both still out there circulating on the, you know, the internet book sites like Amazon, on my own personal website. So they're still available, yes.
All right, very good. Well, stick with us. Michael Cremo is our special guest tonight. If you need to email me, that's very simple. It's george@coasttocoastam.com. And as Michael said, he's got his main website, which is mcremo.com. But there are other two related websites that are linked up right now to his name at coasttocoastam.com. We make it very user-friendly for you to get to their websites, and Lex has them posted for at least several days. And then when you go into past guests on the navigation bar, their websites stay there on the website until the end of time. So as long as they have their website, you can get to it. I'll be back in a moment with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, we are going to be talking with a medical doctor and his patient And they both claim that she is the reincarnated Marilyn Monroe. Lex had a feature story on it yesterday on the coasttocoastam.com website. So we'll talk with them tomorrow in our first hour, and then those special Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. Well, we're back at you with our guest, Michael Cremo. Michael, do you believe these civilizations, the past civilizations, the six major ones that have come and gone, what caused them to disappear? Was it earth changes, man-made disasters? What kind of calamities? All of the above?
Earth changes, basically. Time goes in cycles. Just like every year we have like a cycle of, the temperate countries at least, of spring, summer, fall, and then winter, and then it starts over again. So these cycles go like that. And within the larger cycles that I talked about, there are sub-cycles. And this is something that practically every wisdom tradition in the world has understood. You know, the Greek philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, the Romans, they had a cycle of ages, of four ages, a golden age that's followed by a silver age, followed by a bronze age, followed by an iron age, mm-hmm. after which there's destruction, and then the thing starts all over again. The ancient Sanskrit writings describe a similar cycle, that there's a cycle of ages, which they call yugas. There's a Satya Yuga, a golden age in which most people are very peaceful and spiritual and very healthy and long-lived, and they have very, very advanced abilities, although a very, very simple level of culture.
That's the lifestyle I want again.
Right. Then in the next age, things become a little bit degraded because the people start developing a little bit of selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
So then they start dividing into classes, and you get a social structure that emerges, and towns and villages and cities begin to emerge. And then in the next stage, it gets a little bit more complicated. And finally, in the fourth age, which we're in now, it's called the Kali Yuga. It's called an age of quarrel and hypocrisy, which was a pretty good prediction, because this was predicted. This current age that we're in, it was predicted thousands of years ago in these ancient Sanskrit writings, mm-hmm. and the predictions are all coming true.
What caused this horrible, as you would say, devolution to occur? How do we start off so spiritual, so advanced, and then trail down? You would think we'd go the other way.
One good thing is that it'll start up again, from that point.
From the high point.
But I think it's natural when you consider, okay, you give people some advantages, and those who are smart will take advantage of them in the proper way, and others are going to misuse it. Those who are taking advantage of it properly, they'll get out of the system, because this is another whole aspect of this devolution process, that originally we don't belong in this world. We belong on some other higher level of reality that's beyond all these cycles. It's only some of us that drift down to this level, and then we get caught up in these cycles, and then we have to remain in them. You were mentioning on your next show, you're going to be talking about reincarnation.
Right.
So that's something. So those who take advantage of the process when it's good, in those good times, if they take advantage of the opportunity, they can, through contemplation, yoga, mystic processes, prayer, whatever, they can get out of the whole cycle. If they don't, then you're there for the next act of the show, where you still have a chance to get out, but it's going to be a little bit harder. So I think we see this all the time. People are given a chance, and say, take advantage of the chance now, because later, you know, say to buy something, because if you don't buy it now, it's going to cost you more later. Maybe some people will buy the object then and take advantage of it, and those that don't, well, they'll have to endure the higher prices later on.
The biblical flood, was that one of these major earth changes that wiped out the civilizations?
I think we see this idea of natural catastrophes, periodic natural catastrophes, mentioned in practically all wisdom traditions in one form or another. I think in the different traditions, they may be, you know, described in slightly different ways, but I think it's obvious if we look at the history of the world. You look at the Mayan calendar, for example, which, you know, people are talking about now. It talks about periodic catastrophes. The ancient Sanskrit writings talk about these periodic catastrophes. The Bible mentions one, but I believe that there were many before that. So I think we see the same thing reflected in a lot of different wisdom traditions and ancient sources of knowledge.
Michael, devolution, give me your full definition of that, because that was kind of a reversal on what so many people have been thinking.
Well, yes. You know, in this earlier book, you know, Forbidden Archaeology, what I did is I presented a lot of evidence, a lot of archaeological evidence in the form of human skeletons, human artifacts, and human footprints going back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. It contradicts, you know, the current theory of human origins, which says, you know, that human beings like us evolved, you know, from some more primitive ape-like ancestors, and that humans like us came into existence only about 100,000 years ago or so. So you've got all this evidence that contradicts the current theory. So scientists and the general public ask me, well, if you're saying we didn't evolve from, you know, the apes and ape men, and then where did we come from? So the book Human Devolution is my answer, you know, to that question, and it's based on my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. But to put it very, very simply, we didn't evolve up from matter. We devolved or came down from a level of pure consciousness or spirit. And actually what I'm proposing is, I mean, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being?
Exactly, and why?
Yeah, because today, you know, a lot of scientists are going to say, well, you're just a bunch of chemicals. That's what you are. You're just a product of random evolution. You're just another kind of animal. You're an evolved ape. You're a bunch of chemicals. That's what you are. However, I think if we actually look at all of the evidence that comes to us from various fields of human experience and scientific investigation, we're going to see it's more reasonable to say that a human being is not just a combination of matter. We're a combination of three things. Matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is, but beyond that, there is a subtle mind element, and then beyond that, there is the element of consciousness or spirit, if you like that word. And when I call these things mind and consciousness elements, I mean real elements, just like gold is an element, silver is an element. I'm not talking about just temporary, you know, bioelectrical activity in the brain. I'm talking about them as real substances. And then once we've established that, there's a lot of evidence that we could talk about that establishes the existence of a subtle mind element that can act in very unusual ways. That takes us into the area of a lot of paranormal research. There's also a lot of scientific evidence that shows there's a conscious self that can exist apart from the body, go from body to body. The reincarnation memories provide evidence for that. Medical reports of out-of-body experiences. So when you put it all together, you see, yes, a human being is a combination of matter, mind, in consciousness or spirit. And then that leads to another idea, namely that we live in a multi-level cosmos where at each level you have beings adapted to the conditions at that level.
Different types?
Yes, we now find ourselves on the level of the cosmos that's dominated by gross matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living among other living things that are adapted to the conditions there. Beyond that, there is a level of the cosmos dominated by the subtle mental energies inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. And down through history, people have had a lot of different names for these beings. They've called them astral beings, ghosts, spirits, gods, goddesses, things of that sort, angels. And I believe they really do exist. And then beyond that, there is a level of the cosmos dominated by pure consciousness or spirit, and it's inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. So what I'm proposing is that we begin our existence at that topmost level of the cosmos, but if we become attracted by the lower energies, we descend into them, we become covered by them, and that's what I mean by devolution, the process by which a pure conscious being descends into these lower levels of the cosmos, becomes covered by the lower energies of mind and matter. However, it is a process that can be reversed, and every great spiritual tradition of the world has some process of contemplation, yoga, prayer, meditation, something that will help restore consciousness to its original pure state.
What got you interested in all of this, Michael? Something must have got you to wake up a long time ago and say, I'm going to devote my career to this.
Well, yes. I mean, that happened to me back in the late 1960s. When I was in my early 20s, I was a student at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., it was a time of great troubles for this country. I remember seeing the Capitol burning after the assassination of Martin Luther King, the 82nd Airborne Division coming in to take over. And it was also the time of an anti-war movement, just like there's something like that. Now, it was a very, very, very difficult time, and I just decided I wanted to take myself out of the whole situation. I wanted to, because I'd heard, I was hearing people on this side of the political question saying one thing, people on the other side of the political question saying another, and I just thought, I just want to see what I think myself. I want to find truth myself. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go search around the world, and I'm going to see what I can find that makes sense to me. So I began a little bit of a journey of self-discovery. It first took me to Iceland and then to Europe, and then I went to the Middle East. I spent some time in Israel. Then I went through some of the Middle Eastern countries like Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan. I made a pretty big search during that period, and I found what made sense to me was the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. I came in contact with the teachings of one of the gurus from India, Bhaktivedanta Swami,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the teachers of George Harrison, for example. And through him, I became interested in these historical questions. I began looking at these ancient Sanskrit writings, and I found, okay, they describe human civilizations that existed millions of years ago in the past, going right back to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth.
It is amazing.
And then I looked at something, it's not just in those ancient Sanskrit writings. I began to see, well, the same thing is in the Bible, it's in the Quran, it's in the Egyptian writings, the Romans, the Greeks, practically all the people who have ever existed on this planet, except for us today, have believed that humans have been around since the beginning, that we came ultimately from some spiritual level of reality, from some higher level of the cosmos. So I began to think, well, if what all these ancient wisdom traditions down through history have been saying is true, there should be some physical evidence to support it. So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology, and that's when I began to find out, well, there is physical evidence to support this idea of extreme human antiquity. And then, of course, I also began researching the question, well, if we didn't come from matter, as we're now being told, where did we come from? So that's that. Of course, one thing is, there are a lot of different ways to find out about these things. One thing is to actually engage in the spiritual disciplines themselves, because you can get knowledge that way. And that's what I did. I found something that worked for me. I found a system of meditation that worked for me. I've been practicing it for over 30 years. But some people, at first, the way the world is set up today, they're very reluctant, you know, to perhaps to take up something like that themselves. They want to know, what does science have to say about these questions? So for people like that, I decided, okay, well, let me see what science says about these questions. Let's see if science admits the existence of a subtle mind element that can act in ways that we can't explain by our current laws of physics. Of course, if you look in the current textbooks of physics, you're not going to find anything like that. But I decided, okay, well, let me look into the whole history of physics. I looked, for example, at Pierre and Marie Curie, who are very famous physicists. They were husband and wife. They lived at the early part of the 20th century.
Nobel Prize winners.
They got Nobel Prizes for discovering radium and doing all the early research on radioactivity and everything like that. They're mentioned in every physics textbook. What you don't find mentioned in the physics textbook is that they were heavily involved in psychical research.
Huh.
They were part of a group of 20 prominent European scientists who were doing this research in Paris early in the 20th century. And the group included 5 Nobel Prize winners, including the Curies, and they were doing experiments with mediums. Like they did 2 years of experiments with an Italian medium named Eusebia Palladino. And these experiments were not taking place in somebody's dark living room, which is the usual stereotype, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These experiments took place in scientific research institutions in Paris, like the Psychology Institute in Paris. And on one occasion, Marie Curie was controlling this woman's hands. Other scientists were holding her feet, completely controlling her. And in the middle of the laboratory room, Pierre Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said a large table was floating in the middle of the air. He was timing how long it was floating in the air, measuring how high it was floating off the floor, about 3 feet. And, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. After 2 years of experiments, the whole group of scientists signed documents saying these things are absolutely true. Pierre Curie wrote letters to his prominent physicist friends saying these things are absolutely true. We have to take them into account, you know, if we're going to have a complete picture of reality. But you're never going to see that mentioned in your high school physics textbook, in your college physics textbook. And, you know, this kind of research is going on even today. You know, Robert John, who was head of the engineering department at Princeton University, started doing experiments with random number generators.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the random number generator is a machine, a computer-like machine that will generate an output of zeros and ones.
That's right.
He found students would sit in front of these machines. He would ask them to get them to produce more ones than zeros. They were actually able to do it just by their mental intention.
They could spec it. Michael, stay with us. An hour is gone. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Michael Cremo. We'll be back with Michael in a moment. Some of the things that he has written about in his first book, Forbidden Archaeology, absolutely stunning. We'll talk about that and human devolution on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with our guest, Michael Cremo. Michael, where do you think we came from?
Well, to put it very simply, we did not come up from matter on this planet, as most scientists now tell us. Rather, we've come from a higher level of the cosmos, a level dominated by pure consciousness or spirit.
Or one would say God.
Yes, I think if we actually look at consciousness, say I'm conscious, you're conscious, every one of our listeners out there is conscious, otherwise we wouldn't be in this position. So one thing we notice about consciousness, it's individual, it's personal. Each of us has our own personal consciousness. And to me, that suggests that the source of all conscious beings is also individual and personal. Now, you can call that God if you like. And it seems to me what's really happened is if we give up our connection with the source of all conscious beings, then we've got to have some place to go. And here, where we are now, that's the place. This is the place for us to act out our fantasies that we ourselves are gods, that we ourselves are meant to control and dominate everything. And that's why you see so much competition in the world. You've got so many people thinking that they are number one, either individually or collectively. And it breeds a lot of conflict in the world, as we see.
And a lot of greed and everything else.
Absolutely.
Do you believe that there's extraterrestrial life that has gone through then this same kind of devolution as we have, which means then that they didn't come from matter, they came from this spiritual or other realm?
Here's how I think it works. There is that topmost level of pure consciousness or spirit. And it's possible for all conscious selves to remain there if they want to. However, each conscious self has free will. If it misuses its free will, it descends into the lower levels of the cosmos. Now, some conscious selves, some spirits, they may descend to the level of what I call the mind element. And there, the conscious self may become covered by the subtle mental energies, and such conscious selves may exist on that level as astral beings, angels, gods, goddesses, whatever. As I said, people down through history have had different names for these types of beings, and I think they also are reflected in the modern UFO alien abduction phenomenon, because you've got two groups of researchers in that field. One tends to think that they are simply beings like us, material beings making use of material spacecraft, you know, from some other place on our level of the cosmos. However, there's another group of researchers, an example being John Mack, the psychiatrist from Harvard
right.
University.
God rest his soul.
Right. I actually met him at a Crop Circle conference in England the same year that he left this world as a result of that horrible
accident
yeah. or whatever that happened.
Yeah, he got hit by some drunk driver or something.
Right.
Supposedly.
So he had, you know, heard about, you know, this alien abduction, you know, phenomenon. And he began investigating it as a psychiatrist, and he found the people that were reporting these things, they weren't insane, they weren't neurotic or psychotic, they were perfectly normal human beings who were displaying the same sorts of symptoms that, say, soldiers who had been involved in a battle
mm-hmm.
or humans, that ordinary people who had been involved in some crime had been attacked or something. In other words, they were displaying post-traumatic stress symptoms. And he determined, well, the phenomenon appears to be genuine, and that got him in a lot of trouble with his colleagues at Harvard who tried to get him removed from his position. You know, they convened an academic court to try to have him removed, but he successfully fought that. And in his book, Passport to the Cosmos, he said it appears ever more likely that we exist in a multi-level cosmos. you know, inhabited by different sorts of beings existing on the different levels, which I agree with 100%. That's exactly what I'm saying. And he himself admitted it's not an idea that's an original with him or me or anybody else. It's the common heritage of humankind, you know, down through history, that's the picture of reality that we have. So there are these beings that exist on that level. It's possible to come down to the further level that we now exist in, the level of the grosser material elements, where we have a covering not only of mind but of matter. So if we, you know, want to ask the question, well, where did we all come from? Well, I think we all came from that topmost level of pure consciousness or spirit, and according to our different destinies and desires, we've come down to different levels. As I said, there are some souls who are existing at that level of the subtle mental energies, and there are some of us who have come down to this level of gross matter. But it's possible to reverse the process. You know, there's a process of spiritual re-evolution. And I think every tradition has some kind of process of prayer, meditation, or yoga that is meant to help us do that, restore consciousness to its original pure state. And here I'm not talking about the more external forms of religion, which can be such a source of conflict.
Absolutely.
As we see in our world today.
They really can convolute everything.
I know, but I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about spiritual technologies, just like a geologist can tell us how to extract the pure element gold from its ore, where it may be mixed with less valuable elements. Now, once you've got the gold, you could form it into coins, and you could stamp the coins with the symbols of different nations. But if it's really gold, it doesn't matter what symbol you've stamped on it. And I think it's the same with these spiritual practices. If you're actually able to extract the pure element of consciousness or spirit from its covering elements, then I think it doesn't matter what you label it. You could call it Hinduism or Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Native American or Australian Aboriginal. It doesn't matter what label you put on it. If you're actually able to come to that platform where you see, I am a spiritual being, everyone else is also a spiritual being, we're all from the same source. You know, there's no reason for any of us to be fighting over matter. You know, I mean, I think it's the fundamental problem that we face in this world today, that you've got two kinds of people. You've got one type of person who is striving to realize the self within and its connection with the source of all conscious beings, and being able to recognize every other human being, not just even every other human being, but every other living thing.
And I would say most of those are listening to this program today.
I would think so, and I think it's very fortunate. But then there's the other kind of person that wants to focus not on the commonalities, but on the divisions. And we can see what they're prepared to do on the basis of those perceived differences,
mm-hmm,
and divisions. So I think we've each got to decide, you know, where we're going to put ourselves.
When you wrote the book Forbidden Archaeology, and there are some incredible things in there that would make one think that humankind has been around for a long, long time. Was there anything that was the most compelling for you? Was it those small steel balls, for example, you were telling me about, Michael, that were found that looked like they had some kind of marking on it or something? Remember those little small steel balls?
Well, those are from South Africa. There are some miners there have found these very interesting round metallic objects. I call them metallic because they're made of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron. And what's the most interesting feature of these objects is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each of them.
Yeah, each one of them has that groove.
Well, something, one groove or two or three or four, but they're most of them have several, and they're parallel, and they go all the way around. Now, some skeptics will say, well, it could be possible that these round objects could have formed naturally, but then somebody took them out of the ground and made these grooves on them. But, I've been to South Africa. I visited the chief mining engineer from the mine where these objects come from, and he showed me like a solid block of rock, a solid block of stone with many of these round hematite objects solidly embedded in the stone with the grooves. You can see the grooves on the part that extended out of the stone. Some of the round objects were kind of partially sticking out of the stone.
And how big were they, Michael?
But they're about 1 or 2 inches in diameter. They're different sizes. They're not big like basketballs or small.
But they're not little BBs.
No, they're not like little BBs either. They're medium size, 1 or 2 inches in diameter. And the ones that were partially sticking out of the stone, they also had the grooves going all the way back around into the solid stone. So you can't say that, well, somebody just took these things and engraved these marks on them. Although those are very interesting, and to me they're very interesting because they're found in layers of solid rock about, 2 billion years old. To me they're very interesting until somebody can come up with some convincing naturalistic explanation how those things could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth. I think we have to consider the possibility that they were made by someone with human-like intelligence. Now, people have had a lot of different theories, to explain them. Some explain them as maybe perhaps having been left by time travelers, and others propose some kind of extraterrestrial explanation. And I favor the idea that they were made by some kind of beings with human-like intelligence that were existing on Earth in those very ancient times. But what's been more fascinating to me is not any one particular case, but to me what was most fascinating was the sheer number of cases. When I first started this research back in 1984, it took me 8 years to do the research for this book, but I didn't think it was going to take 8 years. I thought, well, I'll do 8 weeks of research. I'll find some interesting cases. I'll write a little article or maybe a small pamphlet about it, and then I'll go on to something else. But when I actually started looking into it, when I actually started looking into the original archaeological reports, not what you find in the textbooks, but going back to the original archaeological reports over the past 150 years in all the different languages, German, French, Spanish, Italian, English, Russian, when I started looking at those original archaeological reports, I found one case after another of this evidence for extreme human antiquity. And it added up to hundreds of cases. The 8 weeks of research turned into 8 months. The 8 months turned into 8 years because one case just led to another. And to me, that was the most astonishing thing. Not that there were one or two striking cases, but that there were literally hundreds of these cases that weren't being mentioned in the textbooks, although they are there in the original scientific literature.
There's a moon of Saturn that looks much like those metal balls we were just talking about.
Somebody sent me a picture of that.
Yeah, it's Iapetus is the name of the moon.
Right, Iapetus. Right. And somebody sent me a picture of
the ridge that goes around the equator is 60,000 feet high, but it's on. You really could look at your materials that you were just talking about and this moon, and they look almost the same. It's weird.
Yes, it is. Maybe there's some kind of connection there. People have offered some different kinds of suggestions. Maybe these things are game pieces. Maybe they could be models of
spent fuel of a craft, maybe.
That's a possibility, or models of different objects in the solar system.
Well, I don't know. It is bizarre. Now, but of everything that you uncovered in forbidden archaeology, what's the one that baffled you the most? The one that really got you interested? Was it these metal balls, these iron balls? What?
Well, the case that I always found most fascinating, maybe it's because I live in California, is the California gold mine discoveries. I mean, that's what I found to be very, very, you know, interesting, because the miners, they came to California during the gold rush days, and they went to the Sierra Nevada mountains, and they were digging for gold. And to get the gold, they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains, like Table Mountain, which is near Sonora in Tuolumne County in central California.
Right.
And deep inside these tunnels, maybe 1,000 or more feet inside in the solid rock, they were finding human skeletons, human artifacts, and it was just amazing. And what I found really amazing is that these discoveries were reported by the chief government geologist of California, a man named Dr. J.D. Whitney, and he wrote a huge report about them that was published, by Harvard University, which is the most famous university in the United States. And despite that, these things just were not mentioned in the textbooks.
Why?
And it was because of this process of knowledge filtration. There was another scientist who was living at the same time as Whitney. His name was William Holmes, and he was an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And what he said was, and he was a more prominent scientist than Whitney in the scientific establishment in the United States, so his pronouncements were considered authoritative. So what he said was, he said, if this Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, then he wouldn't have announced those discoveries despite the imposing array of testimony with which he was confronted, because he had cases from all over the gold mining region, not just one place. So I thought that was just really fascinating, because it showed that the reason why these discoveries were put aside was simply because they contradicted the theory of evolution. And it was directly stated by the scientist that this was the main reason why he was rejecting them. And I just found that to be just so amazing, that evidence can be rejected simply because it contradicts the theory of evolution. Now, what I found even more fascinating was that these objects, some of the discoveries are still in the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. So a few years ago, there was a television producer named Bill Cote, who produced the first big film that he produced that was shown on television was about the Sphinx. He was the one who brought the work of John Anthony West
sure, who was just on the program.
And those people, who showed that the Sphinx was far older, than most scientists
right.
now believe. Then he got into this other topic, and he got in touch with me, and he said he would like to put some of the material from Forbidden Archaeology in his next NBC mm-hmm. television special, which was called The Mysterious Origins of Man. And I told him, well, one case you should probably try to, get some film on would be these California gold mine discoveries. So he went to that museum at the University of California at Berkeley, but they just refused to let him film the objects.
Why?
They gave him all kinds of excuses. First, they said, you're making a television program. You probably have a very tight deadline.
Yeah.
He told, I've got 6 months to do the show. Could we have a look, please? And then they said, we'd have to pay our workers overtime to do this. We don't have the money. So he said, I'll give them the money. But finally, they just said, no, go away.
That's amazing. Michael, stay with us. Back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What a fast night. Well, Lex and his able assistant, Sean, have been working around the clock to get you all set. Those of you who would like to play with Streamlink for free, get an idea what that is. This coming weekend, beginning Friday, you'll have a free 3-day Streamlink weekend. You're invited to test drive Streamlink, where it features MP3 downloads, live streaming, classic shows, and some other great features. Just have some fun. Just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and you'll learn how to take advantage of the free Streamlink weekend. And welcome back with our guest, Michael Cremo, right here on Coast to Coast. Michael, why do you think mainstream science won't even open up the door to look at these possibilities, these theories, these things we've talked about tonight?
Well, it's not as simple as that because, you know, mainstream, even mainstream science is not monolithic. There is a very influential, powerful group within mainstream science who wants to keep the door closed. That's absolutely true. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want others to hear what I have to say. Now, fortunately, even within mainstream science, there are some who are willing to listen to new ideas. And because of that, I've gotten a lot of invitations to some of the top scientific institutions in the world. I was invited by the Royal Institution in London to make a presentation about forbidden archaeology. I was invited by the Department of Anthropology, by the Russian Academy of Sciences. I've been invited by organizations such as the World Archaeological Congress and European Association of Archaeologists to present papers. So it's not that all of them are like that. However, some are, and they're very influential, and their voices are pretty loud, and they have a lot of influence in the scientific world. Why are they so resistant? I think there are a lot of reasons for it. I think one reason is it's just human nature. For example, if I love somebody, and then somebody tells me something bad about the person I love. At first, I don't want to believe it.
You're in denial.
I may become angry at the person who tells me, and I think they're like that. They're very much in love with their current theories. They're very much in love with themselves, and if somebody says something that contradicts them or their theories, then they don't want to hear it. They become angry at the person who tells them, and I think that's one reason. I think there are deeper reasons that have to do with power, and through the, it's amazing how this works, but there are different kinds of power in the world. There's military power, there's economic power, there's political power, there's also intellectual power, which is a very subtle power, but a very real one nevertheless, and here's how it works. You know, the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by the answers that we give to the fundamental questions, who am I and where did I come from? Now, through their monopoly, through their government-enforced monopoly in the education system, the evolutionists have had the power for the past 100 years to dictate to everyone else the answers to those fundamental questions, who am I and where did I come from, and they've been giving very materialistic answers.
True.
To those questions. So they're telling us you're just a bunch of chemicals, you're an evolved ape, you're just another kind of animal. You're a purely material being, and that's all there is to it. And therefore, I think it's no surprise at all that our whole worldwide human civilization has become quite materialistic, so much so that most people think that the primary purpose of human existence is simply to produce and consume more and more material things.
Gosh, would you have been a great professor? I would have attended all your classes.
But the problem is that process of material production and consumption generates huge amounts of wealth. Some of it goes
That's
into
right.
the pockets of the scientists who invent the weapons, the medicines, the drugs, the consumer products. More of the money goes into the pockets of the industrialists who manufacture the weapons, the drugs, the medicines, the consumer products. And some of it goes into the pockets of the government officials who tax all this economic activity. So there are powerful forces that would like to see this process go on uninterrupted. Because you notice, if economic activity, if the gross national product goes down even a percentage point, it causes shockwaves around the world. Just like after 9/11, people stopped buying. They stopped flying. They stopped purchasing. They just wanted to sit with their friends and relatives and think, well, what's going on with this world, which I think is a good thing to do. However, because of that drop in economic activity, it caused shockwaves all over the world. We're still suffering from it. The airlines haven't recovered. It's just amazing. So there are powerful interests in this world who would like to see us remain focused totally on this process of material production and consumption. And a key element of that is the scientists who are telling us we are just material beings, and therefore we should be just focusing on that. But what if we had a different set of answers to this fundamental question, who am I and where did we come from? What if in all the schools and universities and all the top scientific institutions, our educators and scientists were telling us, we are beings of pure consciousness, and we should be putting some of our human energy, more of our human energy, into developing the resources of consciousness and spirit rather than totally focusing on this process of material production and consumption. That they don't want, because less human energy going into that process of material production and consumption means people are going to be less under the control.
That's right.
And that means that's going to be less money, less wealth and power, going to the people it's now going to. So I think that's the real reason. I mean, because, sometimes people think these questions like, what's the antiquity of the human species or whatever? What does it matter whether we think human beings have been around for a few thousand years or a few million years? I mean, aren't these just some sort of abstract intellectual questions for a few scientists or philosophers to argue about in their ivory towers? How does it affect us? But actually, the answers to these questions, who am I and where did I come from, they affect every one of us in a very, very deep way.
Michael, not only are you correct, you're right on, but it's a battle, and I'm not so sure we're going to be able to convince the right people. I mean, not to give up by any means, but I think they're going to fight it.
Well, absolutely they will. They will fight it. But one thing that gives me hope is most people actually already agree with me. That's a very, very interesting fact. I mean, surveys have been done, Gallup surveys have been done in this country. Only about 10% of the people actually accept the standard theories of human origins, the evolution theory, we came from the apes theory, as the scientists are trying to teach it in the schools and the universities. Only about 10% of the American people actually accept that, which to me is a very positive thing. The same surveys show that, 50 to 60% of the American people, believe in different kinds of paranormal phenomena. They believe they've communicated with dead people. So most people are already on the right side of the question. However, the problem is that those who are supporting the other view, they have inserted themselves into the very influential and controlling positions in society. But I don't think that's something that can go on for a long time. Even scientists, for example, who appear to be quite orthodox in their views, it's very interesting. A few years ago, I can't name this scientist, but he invited me to come and speak. He was a geologist. He invited me to come and speak at one of the major universities in one of the central states in the United States, and he invited me to speak to the entire geology department of the university, all the professors and graduate students of geology at that university. And I asked him, why did you invite me to do this? It seems very strange, because he's a full professor, he's published textbooks, the scientific articles and all the big scientific publications, appears quite orthodox. I said, how did you learn about me, and why did you invite me to come and speak about forbidden archaeology at your university? He says, well, I heard you on Coast to Coast. so you don't know who's listening.
Oh, we've got all kinds.
Yeah.
All kinds of we're going to take phone calls next hour, Mike. A lot of people have been sending me messages. They're just biting at the bit here to get to you, to ask you some things. What are you working on next?
Well, in the years since Forbidden Archaeology came out, I've gotten information about a whole lot more cases. So it's enough to make a new book. Of course, it takes me a long time. I'm calling the book Forbidden Archaeology 2 as a working title. It takes me a while to put these things together.
Because they're large books.
They're big books, and I have to do the research, because I have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and things like that. But it's very interesting that some of the information that I'm getting is coming from listeners of your show and shows like yours. It's very, very interesting. For example, one listener wrote to me, after hearing me on your show, I believe it was a couple of years ago. He wrote, "You got a great book," and he was from Oregon. He said, "Here in the Waldo Mining District near O'Brien at the Easterly Mine, stone bowls and pestles were found in cemented ancient riverbed. They were so firmly cemented, the miners had to remove them with extreme care. Again, thank you for the great book." So I asked him, "All right, I wrote back to him and I said, okay, you told me about this case. Do you have any kind of documentation about it?" So he sent me a newspaper article, a very interesting newspaper article from the year 1904 from the Rogue River Courier up there in Oregon. And the title of the article was Relics of Ancient Age, Mortars of Prehistoric Time Found in Weimer Brothers Mine. So the report gave very detailed information about the geological situation where these artifacts were found. So they're found in old gravel of an ancient river channel, 50 or 60 feet below the surface, firmly embedded in the cemented gravel near the bedrock. So then from that information, I went to some scientific reports. I began looking at the scientific geological reports about that area to see if I could get any idea how old those particular layers where the human artifacts were found. And it turned out they're over 2 million years old. So that's one of the cases that will be in this book that I'm working on now, Forbidden Archaeology 2, and I think it's very significant. It came to my attention through one of the listeners.
The Vedics that you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
They talked about flying machines. They talked about wars. Now, were you ever able to determine whether these flying machines were hours of the time, our kind of technology, human technology, or were they witnessing extraterrestrial visitations?
It appears they were of several different kinds, because as I mentioned before, it appears that we live in a multi-level cosmos. So there are very detailed descriptions of these aircraft and spacecraft. They're called Vimanas, given in these ancient Sanskrit writings. They're not like just some vague mentions. They're very detailed descriptions of them. Some of them were made of iron and metals like we're familiar with.
Sure.
And they came from other parts of our level of the cosmos. And so they're described. Some of those are described. And some of them come from this more subtle region, from the more subtle regions of the cosmos, and they have different kinds of abilities. Yeah, it's very strange. These, if you look carefully at the reports of the modern UFO phenomenon, you'll see that, well, some of them appear to be quite clunky machines, mm-hmm. but some of them, once I was giving a lecture on forbidden archaeology in Germany, and there was a pilot for one of the major American airlines that flies across the Atlantic. He had come to the lecture, and afterwards he was talking to me. And we got onto the topic of UFOs for some reason. And he told me how once he was flying across the Atlantic in a 747, he said he saw coming directly towards him, he saw an object, flying object coming directly towards
him. I was scared the heck out of him.
And it was closing at just this fantastic rate of speed. And he said, just before it hit the plane, it just went straight up.
Oh.
Just straight up.
Did he see detail on it?
And he said, he told me, he said, but we never report stuff like this because the second that you're supposed to report it, but he said, if you report it, then your career is pretty much finished. You'll be investigated. So the point being that the modern reports of some of these UFOs show that they fly, they conduct themselves in ways that no plane made out of, you know, metal, you know, could possibly endure the G forces. You know, that, you know, you can't do a 90-degree, you know, straight up turn like that at that rate of speed. It would, the plane would just disintegrate.
Those are great stories,
you
Michael.
So I think that, as I said, a lot of the there's one group of the modern UFO alien abduction type researchers that see that the phenomenon sort of shades more into the mystical, paranormal, spiritual type of area. So I think these ancient Sanskrit writings, they describe both kinds of things. They describe some of these craft as being made of ordinary metals and things like that, but others are being more composed of more subtle energies and operating on a different level.
God, that's incredible stuff. Can you imagine being in a plane, seeing that coming at you? And I'm sure he had a co-pilot, right?
Yeah, he didn't talk about what his co-pilot said.
But, that was a expletive deleted, right?
But there's, I mean, there's just so much reporting on these things. Just a few weeks ago, I was giving a talk about forbidden archaeology at a conference called the Forbidden Knowledge Conference. It was held in Stoke-on-Trent in England.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, yeah, if you're going to have a forbidden knowledge conference, you got to have the forbidden archaeologist come.
And he's got to have you.
But,
that's right.
Sure. But for me, a lot of times when I go to these conferences, the most interesting thing or most pleasant thing for me is to meet some of the other researchers. So I met Nick Pope, who was, until a few years ago, he was with the British Defense Department. He was in the department that dealt with UFO reports. And, you know, he was, you know, just, you know, confirming that, yeah, these things are there. I mean, it's really amazing. So you have reports coming not just from crackpot people. You've got, you know, people who are officials in the military establishment reporting that these things are definitely out there.
I think more and more of these reports, Michael, are coming from good, solid witnesses.
Yeah.
I really do. But again, back to the Vedics real quickly before the top of the hour. UFOs or ours? What do you think?
I think they were coming. Most of the ones that are reported in these ancient Sanskrit writings, the Vedas, are from other parts of the cosmos. They're not ours.
Ah, okay. So they were witnesses.
Yes.
To these events.
Yes.
That's fascinating all by itself. Stay with us with our special guest, Michael Cremo. I'll tell you what, let's open up the phone lines. So when we come back, it'll be your turn to ask him a question or two about some of the things we've talked about. We'll also have him tell you about this incredible story about the dinosaur prince and the human prince. That's a great story. Back in a moment with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. And with Michael Cremo, our guest, let me tell you, the phone lines are sizzling. So we'll be back with Michael in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, tell us the incredible story of these dinosaur prints with the human footprints right near them. And was this Nebraska where these were found?
I think you're talking about the Paluxy River case, which comes from Texas. You know, originally I was a little skeptical about those. I didn't put them into my book, Forbidden Archaeology, because one of the people who originally reported them, a Christian creationist scientist named John Morris Jr., withdrew his claims. You know, he had originally claimed there were some human footprints next to dinosaur footprints, but then he decided, well, what he thought were human footprints were kind of a erosion patterns or something like that. So I sort of put that file away. But then, again, a listener to your show, to Coast to Coast, I believe, got in touch with me. She was an archaeology student in Texas, and she wrote to me and asked, well, is there anything I can do to assist with your research? So I said, well, why don't you go up to Glen Rose, Texas, to Paluxy River, where these alleged human and dinosaur footprints are to be found, and tell me what you think. So actually she went and did that. She was a graduate student of archaeology. She went up there, and she met some of the researchers there, and it so happened they were doing some new excavations. So they were conducting new excavations. They were finding more footprints, and she took photographs, and she gathered reports. And her reporting back to me was that, as far as she could tell, they were genuine human footprints. So she sent me all the reporting and the photographs and things, and I looked them over myself. And I'm going to write about this case and the new book that I've got, because I think I've got better reasons now to think that they might be genuine than I did when I was putting the first book together. So those footprints would be about 100 million years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And now, if that was the only thing that was around at that time, the only evidence that there was, then well, maybe you could question it, but in forbidden archaeology, I've pointed out that you've got not just a few cases from around that time. You've got all kinds of cases of evidence of human beings from before the time of the dinosaurs, during the time of the dinosaurs, after the time of the dinosaurs. So maybe just by itself, the case could be questioned. But when you put it in the context of human skeletal remains, other human footprints, human artifacts going back to the same period of time and even before that, it begins to make a lot more sense.
Okay, let's go to the phones with Michael Cremo. We'll pick it up by going west of the Rockies. Hi there, you're on Coast to Coast.
Yes, this is James from Grand Junction, Colorado.
Hello, James. Thanks for calling.
Michael, I have a story that my family have told to me from the time I was a little kid, and it sounds fantastic, but it's true. Marble, Colorado, the Yule Marble Quarry up there where the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier Monument came from.
How do you spell that, Yule Quarry?
I think it's with a Y.
Okay.
Like Yuletide, you know?
Okay. Okay, got it.
Okay, anyway, they quarried out a big block of marble, like they did every day, I guess, and put it on the tram, and it came down on the tracks and went to the mill down in town there. And when they were cutting this big block of marble in two, they cut a man right in half. And when they folded the blocks apart, there was each half of the man in each block.
Amazing.
And the museum, I guess, from Denver said it was impossible, so they didn't want it. It was kind of like you told,
Knowledge filtering.
And it sat in the mill foreman's office for years, I guess, and that's the last I heard, because our family ties were from the Singletons that lived there in town, and they passed away, And this was probably in the 20s and 30s era there.
Do you know if there were any written reports about it?
I really don't know, but I bet you, that if you get a hold of that company, it's still in existence, because I think, didn't they just replace the monument again?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but it's a good lead, and the name, you don't know the exact name of the company.
Well, it's called the Colorado Yule Marble Quarry. I've already found that.
Okay.
So you can do a Google search for that and a whole bunch of things. The original Colorado Yule Marble Company operated from 1905 until 1941, but it's still out there.
Well, that's, as I said, sometimes this is how I learn about these cases, and I'm grateful for this lead, and I'll try to follow up on it.
Well, thank you very much, and I know it's true, because I heard it from all my family.
Because normally, marble, that's got to be tens of millions of years old.
Yeah, and you wouldn't think it would be possible, would you?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so perhaps many, many years ago, but now I'm quite prepared to believe it's possible. All right. Well,
very
listen.
Good.
Thanks a lot, James. That's great.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast with us, with Michael Cremo. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, nice to talk to you guys.
Thank you.
I've noticed that even as late as last semester, writing a paper, I'm an archaeology anthropology student, that I was still receiving heat for challenging the Clovis First issue. I thought it had died decades ago, but apparently not. I don't want to name the professor. I'm at a nationally ranked university, and even including, you know, Monteverde, Meadowcroft, the Topper site, you know, there may be some clinical errors, but they still seem to be grasping at that immovable stone of Clovis First, when it looks like there's just undeniable evidence that the North American, South American, this hemisphere was populated well prior to, you know, the 11,500-year-old rock-hard date that's established in, you know, everyone's mind. I just wondered if you had any...
And tell us about Clovis First, if you would.
I'll do that. Clovis is a place where some spearheads, stone spearheads, arrowheads were discovered in the 1930s, and there were, they became that. That's how a lot of artifacts are named, after the place where they're found. So, according to most archaeologists, those are the earliest evidence of a human presence in North America. As the listener was saying, they go back about 11 or 12,000 years. So the standard doctrine is there are no pre-Clovis humans in North America. In other words, there weren't any humans in North America until the time of these Clovis artifacts, which go back about 11 or 12,000 years. But as the listener was mentioning, there are some cases where some archaeologists at Meadowcroft, which is in the eastern United States, have found artifacts that go back perhaps 20,000 years. Now, that's not really so radical, but even that minor deviation, you know, just pushing it back a few thousand years, is being resisted by the supporters of these no pre-Clovis idea, the idea that there are no humans in North America any earlier than about 11,000-12,000 years ago. Now, of course, I mentioned earlier in the show the California gold mine discoveries. They go back 50 million years. But there was an interesting case from Mexico, where some American archaeologists discovered human artifacts at a place called Hoyalaco, and then some geologists from the United States Geological Survey were called to go down there and date the site. One of them was Virginia Steen McIntyre. She and her colleagues used four methods to date the site. They did uranium series dating on bones that were found along with the artifacts. They did zircon fission track dating on layers of volcanic ash that were found above the artifacts. They came up with an age of 250,000 years for this site. This was in the 1970s, and there's new work going on down there right now that's confirming these dates. And you will not see this mentioned in any of the textbooks. The archaeologists who were involved said that's impossible. Human beings weren't present in North America 250,000 years ago. They weren't even present anywhere in the world 250,000 years ago. You know, the current theory is that humans like us came into existence about 100 or 150,000 years ago in Africa. So to have this evidence in North America at 250,000 years was just considered impossible, because it violated this nobody was present before the Clovis artifacts idea that listener was just mentioning. And I think he's experiencing himself, you know, a little bit about how this knowledge, you know, filtering process works, because he said he's writing a paper on it. His professor's disagreeing with him on that, which is I think is part of what the problem is these days. So, fantastic observation from the listener.
Very good. Thank you very much for the call. Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good day, George. This is Scott in Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, Scott. Thanks.
You might remember me from back when you had someone that believed in a young Earth.
Yeah.
I brought up dinosaurs back then.
6,000-year-old Earth, if I remember.
That's right, sir.
Okay.
Anyway, that's one of the key things in which I agree with Michael on a lot of things in which he's been talking about, but except for the issue of the age of the Earth. He used radio dating. Is that as one of the chief issues or ways in which the age is determined? Is that correct, Michael?
That's one way. There's many different ways that geologists and archaeologists use for dating sites and artifacts, but radiometric methods are one of the main methods they use. Yes, they can also use standard, geological reasoning, like looking at how long it would take for certain layers to be deposited. Yeah. Things like that. But yeah, you're right. Radiometric methods are one of the main methods that they use to date sites.
Right. Are you familiar with, you've already mentioned you're familiar with John Morris. The technical journal, or TJ, from Answers in Genesis, several years back has put out an article in which they dated the 1980 dome of Mount St. Helens, and that the dates in which they returned got back from that was anywhere from about about half a million to about 3.5 million years old.
I'm quite prepared to admit that in particular cases the radiometric dating methods can be wrong, but for me, here's how I operate. You have to have some kind of framework for discussion. So what I say to these scientists is this. I say, by methods that you consider reliable, these strata are considered to be 10 million years old, for example. How do you explain the presence in them of these human bones and artifacts or footprints? It's a problem for them. Either they have to admit that all of their dating methods are wrong, or they have to admit their theory of evolution is wrong. So either way, I win.
I hear you on that one. And earlier, this is going off of the what reason.
And I just like to say, I have a lot of, my friends who are young Earth creationists, I tell them, well, look, whether we believe the Earth is a few thousand years old or a few billion years old, humans have been around since the beginning. And then we'll just have to disagree about the age of the Earth later on, But the main thing is the evidence contradicts the theory of evolution.
Great. Hey, thanks for your call. Let's go next to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, my name is Greg. I'm a truck driver driving up through Indiana. I had a question on whether Mike has had any ever found any synthetics in some of the ancient strata relating to some information I've come to across through John Anthony West, Greg Braden, Melchizedek. They describe a situation where as for any synthetics to exist in a three-dimensional world, there has to be a mental blueprint for it in the mass consciousness of mankind to exist, and that through a process where the Earth irregularly shuts down its rotation, the Earth's magnetic field would collapse, and the integrity of this mental blueprint for our three-dimensional expression to exist relies on the integrity of the Earth's magnetic field having an integrity. And when that magnetic field collapses, what automatically happens is any synthetics that would exist from a high culture before automatically just dissolves. There's just And I'm just wondering if you've ever found any synthetics in the ancient strata.
I'm not aware of any reports right now that such have been found. Most of the artifacts that I found reported in the scientific literature are either of like gold, which is a metal with which we're familiar, or stone. Perhaps there are cases where, you know, synthetic materials, I guess you're talking about things that aren't natural, that are manufactured, human manufactured,
right,
like plastics and strange, very strange alloys and things like that. So they may be there, but I don't have any reports of them that I could give right now. Of course, sometimes in these, you know, the Roswell case, you know, the UFO case, they've got some strange synthetics that were found there. But those aren't ancient, very ancient. So my short answer to your question is no. And it is a fact that the Earth's magnetic field does shift. It reverses its polarity, you know, from time to time. And that's
actually, and it's happening now, I think.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the ways that strata and the layers of the Earth can be dated, because you can detect the shifts in the polarity of magnetic particles in the layers of the Earth. So that's one way that they can date stratas, by the polarity of the magnetic particles in those layers.
Hey, Michael, how come you never went on a hunt for Noah's Ark?
You know, actually, I've been very close to Erzurum, where Mount Ararat is.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of in a hurry to get to India, so I didn't stop and go up the mountain. But I have seen Mount Ararat, and I have seen the television programs, some of the documentaries that have dealt with that topic, and I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, well, if anybody finds it, I think it'll be you. So stay with us. Michael Cremo, our guest, will be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Hey, if you're interested in buying some gifts, well, you can go to Coast AM gift shop. You'll find the information on the website over there under the navigation bar. Some brand new items, hats, T-shirts, coffee mugs, you name it. What happens on Mars stays on Mars. And Michael, so what kind of devolution will continue for us, do you think, on this planet?
Well, there's a few kinds. One is that the age that we're in, the Kali Yuga, is one of declining human values, as we're seeing. But just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. You can put up an umbrella, or you can put up a little tent to shelter yourselves and as many people as you can. So I think we've all got choices to make in that regard. There's another way in which the devolution process can proceed, and that's through reincarnation. If we're trying to elevate our consciousness, we will ascend upward through the evolutionary process. However, if we degrade our consciousness, as we see many people doing, they will descend, they will devolve in the evolutionary process, going down to lower and lower species of life. And the other opportunity that we have is to just get out of the whole time cycle, reincarnation cycle, and get back to that level of pure consciousness or spirit. And that's an opportunity that we all have. I found something that works for me, that's come from the tradition that I've developed an interest in. I practice a kind of mantra meditation every day. It's the Hare Krishna mantra meditation. It works for me. But I would just encourage people to look deeply within their own tradition. I think if we look within any tradition, you're going to find some practice of yoga, prayer, and meditation that's meant to help us do that, evolve spiritually, go back to the original position of pure consciousness or spirit.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line, first of all. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's Gary calling you from Chesterfield, Missouri.
Yes, sir. Hi there.
Twice in one night, much less 1 year. I'm doing something right. In fact, I can tell you where I'm at. I'm in Boone's Crossing. You know where that is.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I was going to let you know very quick before I gave you a question. I walked into work last night, and the first thing one of my friends asked me was, that was you on Coast to Coast, wasn't it?
Small world, isn't it?
And they said, George knows you? And I said, now you know why my phone keeps breaking the dial, but, you know. Mr. Cramo, for your guest, I don't know if it's Dr. Cramo or Mr. Cramo.
Well, there is a doctorate.
Okay.
So we'll call him Dr. Cremo, Gary.
Well, I don't use it very. I prefer to be called just Michael, but
okay.
If you're asking.
Michael, my question about it for you is, could you elaborate a little more on a mystery I've read about? I believe it was in places like Puerto Rico and I think Honduras, where they were finding large stone or iron spears that weighed anywhere from several hundred pounds to several thousand pounds, and they were digging these up. And they carbon dated them, found out they were thousands of years old, and the civilizations that were there at that time apparently did not have the apparent means to make these. And thank you for your time on the question. I'll listen to you off the air.
Okay,
on the air.
Sure thing.
Well, it's another case where I learn something every day from the listeners. One of the listeners earlier told me about a case I'd never heard of before, and this one is a little bit new for me. Two, my main area of research is evidence for extreme human antiquity. That means evidence that humans have existed for more than the 100 or 200,000 years that scientists now think possible. It's a new case, so I really can't say anything about it. For me, it's some new information, and I thank the listener for it.
Okay, West of the Rockies, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the show, sir. Go ahead.
Hello, George. This is quite an honor for me to talk to you. I've been listening for a long, long time. I remember when Art Bell got his 60th affiliate.
that must have been about 2,000 years ago.
It was. I drive truck, and I had to pull over. I hope you guys can hear me. Okay.
I can hear you loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, it's really an honor to talk to you. I have two things I want to actually is. A comment and something I'd like Michael to talk a little bit about. About 6 years ago, I was in the right place at the right time. I come from a tribal community up here based around St. Helens, and I had done a lot of volunteer work on dam relicensing and really sitting with a lot of the old people in our tribe and just really had a heartfelt thing to try to preserve some of our old our antiquities, as you would call it, you know. And ended up working for the state SHPO office up here, which is the archaeology office, for 3 years. And my job was basically the basement job of mapping and detailing all of the different layers of files out of the archaeology files, you know, in the files there, into a GIS mapping system, right? And what I ran into is something that you touched on at the very beginning of the show when George asked, well, why doesn't this information get out there? I'd like you to talk a little bit about the economic and political powers, because I really believe that if the information was out there about the origins of archaeology, that they'd have to deal with stories from Native Americans, stories from origins. And that, of course, would be really hard for land use and land use issues, because ultimately archaeology has to do with the land and what's preserved in the land and the culture surrounding that land.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, a few years back there was I don't know if what the exact proper term is, Native American author Vine Deloria, who is, I think, an Apache Indian, but is also a professor of history at the University in Colorado. He wrote a book called Red Earth, White Lies, in which he touched on this topic that you're talking about. And he also mentioned my forbidden archaeology work there. He was mentioning about how the the tribal peoples in Oregon near the Three Sisters Mountains, they have in their legends an account of how those mountains blew up. They exploded, sort of like Mount St. Helens did not a few years ago. So, but what's interesting about this story about these tribal legends about the Three Sisters Mountains, that according to geologists, those explosions took place about 50 million years ago. So the these Native American peoples, at least a good many of them, they don't believe this story that they came over from Siberia, you know, over the Bering land strait, you know, 10 or 12,000 years ago. They think they've been here for a long time. And I think that legend of how those mountains blew up may be some evidence of that. At least Vine Deloria said that. And as I said, those explosions, those volcanic explosions at those mountains took place over 50 million years ago, and the event is still preserved down through history in the legends of the people that lived in that area, the Native American people that lived in that area.
That's something else, isn't it?
And as confirming that, you know, these California gold mine discoveries that I was talking about, they are also about 50 million years old. So I think you're right that there are some issues that go very deep that are involved in keeping certain ideas in power. I also found that to be the case in New Zealand once. I was there, and I was in the Museum of Natural History in Auckland, and I had heard that there were some discoveries there that were being covered up for similar reasons. So I think I'm really glad that you called to make this point. And it's something that I'm attuned to.
What this shows me too, with all these calls that come in, and some of them giving you information for future research, is that there's so much that hasn't even been uncovered yet on this planet, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. I think even all the hundreds of cases that I mentioned in Forbidden Archaeology are only, you know, the tip of the iceberg, really. I think there's a lot more out there to be found. And one of the things that I always find gratifying is I get letters from students of archaeology that tell me they want to devote their careers to finding more of these kinds of things. We even had the archaeology student call a little earlier in the show saying how he was meeting some resistance from his professors when he was reporting some things in one of his papers that he was doing as a class assignment. So I hope these students of archaeology will just keep pushing forward, and let's see what happens.
Next up, first-time caller line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Hey, I'm going through Alabama. I'm a truck driver.
Well, hi there. You sure are.
I just woke everybody up. Okay, I was just wondering, since we all came from, like, Africa or apes or whatever, one central source, how did race...
So they say.
Yeah.
So what was your question?
How did the races, different races, how did we develop, you know, black, white, you know, Asian? I mean, what happened?
Well, you know, the way I look at it, and even modern science will admit that all the races are part of one human species. So I think we're all the same, really, you know, beneath the skin color and everything like that. We're all human beings. But how those differences arose, I think they've been around for a long time. I think it's not something that just came about, recently as a result of human beings having evolved from apes. I think God just made different kinds of people. That's all.
Well, yeah, that's kind of, you know, my theory and, you know, the language and everything. But I was just wondering, you know, if there was some kind of strange or weird theory about how, you know, people look so differently.
Well, they do. If you want to know what the evolutionists think, they think there are all kinds of, you know, genes that control the color of the skin and the shape of the eyes and things like that. and that, you know, because of natural selection and genetic mutations in certain areas of the world, you know, the skin may become darker or lighter, you know, in response to the ability of the skin to absorb vitamin D and things like that. They have, you know, they've got some theories, but they're not really worked out in any scientific way. They're just trying to explain things according to what they think is true. But I think what the real truth is that God just made different kinds of people.
Do you believe in the angelic realm, Michael?
Yes, I do. I was mentioning that earlier, that in my book, Human Devolution, I lay out the idea that we exist in a multi-level cosmos, where you have one level dominated by the grosser material elements and inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. That's where we find ourselves now. But beyond that, there's a more subtle realm of the cosmos inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. People have different names for them. Some people use the word angels. You know, some use the word gods or goddesses, and some use the word astral beings or spirits or something. So people, or even aliens and UFO type beings or something. But whatever name you want to attach to it, I have no objection to the term angelic. It seems like a good one to me.
Me too.
But yeah, it's interesting. If you go back into the early literature on Christianity, they had quite a literature on angels. Now people have a very limited conception of what an angel is, you know, just some kind of little creature playing a harp or something. But you go back to the original Christian literature on angels, and you see there are all kinds of them in charge of different aspects of the universe, of the rains and sun and moon, and different kinds of messengers, and you know, the whole big angelic realm, which you find reflected in the cosmologies of other cultures as well. Practically every culture in the world is believed that there is a subtle realm inhabited by different kinds of gods, goddesses, angels, astral beings, whatever you want to call them. Then beyond that, you know, there is a level of, you know, pure spirit, a spiritual realm where God and his eternal associates are existing. And you find this reflected in the art, the literature, the culture of practically every society that's ever existed down through history.
Okay, let's go to final caller or two. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George and Michael.
Hi, yeah.
My name's Lucas. I'm in Cumming, Georgia. Before I ask my question, I just wanted to tell you that I played the video game Prey. I guess Art Bell had a cameo
Art's,
in it.
Art's little voice is there. That's right.
That added a lot to
the
gaming
experience.
Big
voice. Yeah.
What I wanted to ask was, I had read something on the Internet a couple years back about, I'm not sure where it was on Earth, somewhere in the Middle East, it was something that resembled a spark plug, and it had been carbon dated, and they had found it was millions of years old, and then I didn't hear anything about it again.
No, that's not the Baghdad battery, Michael.
That may be the if it was the spark plug, it might be the COSO artifact, which is found in the United States. And there they found a chunk of rock that had inside it an object. They sawed it in half, and it looked like a spark plug because it had some ceramic, you know, round ceramic type of thing, and then in the middle something metal, and
it was definitely not naturally made. That's for sure.
It's one of those cases that, you know, it's interesting because there's some people who have said, well, it's exactly like a particular type of spark plug that was made, you know, in the 1920s or something like that. So you've got people that say that, and then you've got people that say, no, it's not like that. And for me, what I'm dealing with, any case, whether it's this case or any other case, I look for two things. One is it actually some kind of human bone, human artifact, or human footprint, something that's definitely connected with human beings. So this object is connected with human beings, obviously. And then the other point I look for is how old is it? And for that, I usually need some very good information about exactly where it was found so I can check the geological reports. And on this particular case, there wasn't any very exact information about where it was found. So it's one of those cases, I've got a file on it, but I'm still looking for more information that would confirm how old it actually is.
Michael, we have run out of time, my friend, but I want to thank you. The book, Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology. If you don't have a computer to track this down, let me give you an order info number, 800-443-3361. Michael, thank you.
Well, thank you, George. It's always a pleasure.
Michael Cremo. I just love talking to him. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.